Is that a person doing that, that song? I don't like it.
This
I
song?
I don't like it anymore. I hate the opening music. I hate all the music on the show. It's not your fault, City Limits.
This
I
is just, Fallout Boy.
I can't take it anymore.
It's Fallout Boy.
Well, let him fall out some more. I don't want to hear it anymore. How are you?
I'm better than you, apparently.
I'm actually very good today.
Yes? I've had
two giant cups of coffee, and it's a football Friday. It's a football weekend. There's a million things going on, a million things to talk about, and I don't know how it's going to unfold on the show today. This is much like a football game in and of itself. You and I have a game plan. We've spoken. We have plays we're going to run, so to speak. Little clips that you're going to throw in.
That's right.
Guests we're going to have on the air.
That's right.
Topics to talk about. Yet we have no idea how this will turn out. It could be a disaster. I could be fired by the end of the show. So could you. Or we could deliver a grade A performance and be in line for a raise after this show.
That'd be great.
That's what makes it exciting. They turn on the lights and here we go. And I'm ready, man. I'm ready to start. And I would like to start with a six-pack. It could turn into an eight-pack or a 12-pack. One of the great moments of my life was when Stroh's invented a 15-pack. I used to drive around Buffalo with three friends, and I would be in the back, right? And we would pull up to places because you couldn't go to bars yet, right? So we would have to pull up to places, and I would have Stroh's in the back seat. That was the tradition. Fire brewed Stroh's out of a can. The cans were unbelievable.
And it was the baker's dozen plus two more.
Plus three more. Well, yes, the baker's dozen plus two more. You started out with a 12-pack, and then Stroh's invented the 15-pack. Ooh. In a stroke of absolute genius. What was the beer of choice at Waynesburg, if I might ask?
Joe, I'm not a beer drinker.
That's right. You drink whiskey. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a liquor guy.
Yeah.
So I'm not entirely sure what the beer of choice was.
Who should I ask? Donnie Football?
Yes.
Let's crack one open. Let's get started.
Maybe Harry would know.
Would Harry know?
I don't know. Maybe not.
We're off and running. The Steelers, I mean, the breaks just keep coming here early in the season. I don't want to see anybody get hurt, let alone Micah Parsons, who is a great player. But it's a fact that he was carted off the field last night with some sort of leg, foot injury. I don't know what it is right now. There seem to be mixed reports. They say, or he said, indicated that this could be okay. It doesn't appear to be as dire as it always appears when someone's carted off the field. But the bottom line is he's in doubt. He's in doubt for their game against the Cowboys. And Max Crosby has a high ankle sprain as well. It seems like now every time you turn around, the best player on the other team is in doubt when the Steelers play them. They got Dallas on Sunday night, then the Raiders after that. Crosby's seems like isn't going to play this weekend. He hasn't practiced yet. It's just like every single break that could possibly happen is going their way. When other teams start to lose their best players, include Myles Garrett in this. He's got injuries to both feet, and he's listed with Achilles and hip problems. There seems to be a feeling that he's not going to last very long this season.
He needs to go to the Good Feet store.
That's the vibe I'm getting right now with Myles Garrett. He's their best player. This is now four games coming up later this season, some of them sooner rather than later, where the other team's best player figures to be compromised or not there at all. Now add on to that the Bengals are falling apart, that the Browns are falling apart, that the Ravens are a whisker away from being 0-3. It's almost too good to be true here. And here's a stat for you, Limitless Wonder. You ready for this one?
Fire away.
Before the season, the Steelers had the third toughest schedule in football, projected, right? Based on last year's winning percentage, okay? The third toughest. Not to mention, they were ending with the gauntlet that we all know about after the bye week, okay? 3 weeks in, there's a great website called Tankathon that lists every team's strength of schedule from this point in the season to the end. So the Steelers started with the third hardest schedule. Out of 32 teams, guess where they ranked the rest of the way in strength of schedule?
The Wrong. Fifth best.
The easiest schedule in the NFL right now. And I realize part of that is the Bengals are 0-3, and that's two games you count there. But the Bengals are 0-3, and that's two games you count there. A 4-0-9 strength of schedule the rest of the way. They've gone from third hardest to the easiest projected schedule, at least based on winning percentage so far, in the whole NFL. Limits. What do you make of this?
It's definitely a good thing to look at on the peripheral. But at the same time, we're not completely burying Cincinnati right now.
No, but I don't think people are all... I also don't think people are taking into account just how deep a trouble the Bengals are in.
They're in trouble, but
it's funny for me to read around and watch these shows. Oh, they're going to bounce at it. How do you know? How do you know they won't go to 0-4?
A big reason why that winning percentage is so much lower is because look at your own division. Cincinnati's 0-3.
Sure.
The Browns are 1-2, and
yes.
Baltimore's 1-2, and you will play them 6 times.
Yep.
So that's one significant reason why.
Yeah, now, is that the good news or the bad news?
Well,
I think pretty good news because I think the Browns stink, and I think there's a pretty good chance the Bengals could still fall absolutely apart.
I think that's what sort of distorts that 409 percentage of strength of schedule.
Sure.
Because we know Baltimore's better than a 1-2 team. Cincinnati's better than an 0-3 team. Now the wheels might fall off there, but I don't expect that to happen in Baltimore. Cleveland, I expect everything to continue to fall apart. But also, you're talking about not even 1/4 of the season yet.
I know. We're talking very early in the season, and I keep hearing that from people, but what else are we supposed to talk about? It's very early in the season. We're 3 games in, and everything is falling the Steelers' way. I think they're going to be favored in their next 8 games. They're favored at Indy. They'll be favored at home against Dallas. I think they'll be favored at the Raiders. They'll be favored at home against the Jets and Giants. That's their 6 games before the break, right?
Did that number factor in Dallas being 2-2 or Dallas being 1-2 as well? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know. Limits. You're asking me questions.
It was probably 1-2.
They're going to be favored in every game before the break.
As they should.
Then they'll be favored presumably at Washington, home against Baltimore, and possibly at Cleveland.
I don't know about that Washington game. That might be a pick 'em. Washington might be favored by a point in that one.
It could be. Yeah. But potentially, they could be favored in every game through Thanksgiving. I mean, that's not unrealistic. How about that? So, every time you turn around, there's something else. It's like, wow, can anything else go the Steelers' way? And good for them. Good for them. It's up to them to take advantage of it. Next. By the way, Limits. This is from The Athletic, from the guy who covers the Bengals. There have been 4 AFC North teams to start a season 4-0 since the formation of the division in 2002. 4 teams have started 4-0. All 4 finished with at least 11 wins and won the division. 4-0 is a good place to be. You know what's a bad place to be?
0-4.
And I think the Carolina Panthers in the Andy Dalton Bowl might put it on the Bengals. I don't think that you're honoring the fact, realizing the fact, that the Bengals are torn up defensively. Have you seen the injuries on their defensive line?
They are completely banged up. Like, it's bad.
They may survive this week, but I think people who believe they're going to walk into Carolina and have it easy are out of their minds.
Well, I don't know about easy, but I mean, you're talking about the Andy Dalton Bowl against a team where, sure, maybe they get one spark plug against the Raiders.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we should also factor in Carolina will give a whooping to the Raiders. The Raiders, like,
do we factor in?
Their own coach is questioning people actually attempting to give 100% effort and making business decisions.
Do we factor in that the Bengals have already lost at home to the Patriots and Commanders?
We can.
I think we should. This is not going to be any. Who's favored in this game? What's the point spread? Could you look that up for me?
I will do that right now.
I appreciate that very kindly. Next. This was the Pirate game yesterday. And what a way to finish.
Cincinnati, 4.5.
4.5. What a way to finish for the Pirates. Not only do they lose the game with hardly anybody there, but O'Neill Cruz gets picked off first early in the game and then finishes the eighth inning by rounding second like he doesn't know how many outs there are and getting picked off second during a live play. O'Neill Cruz should not have come out for the ninth inning to his position. Derek Shelton, when he had nothing else to go on, would praise his team for how hard it worked this season. And it just wasn't true. There were too many instances of not working hard, either physically or mentally. And Cruz was at the center of a couple of those. Again, doesn't know how many outs there are. After getting picked off first early in the game, Shelty needed to make a move there. You know, not that, I don't know, does every, I guess you do. You can't help but notice if Cruz doesn't run out to center field. And that brings up the question of the futures of Derek Shelton and Ben Cherington, doesn't it? And Dejan Kovacevic wrote on his website, DK Pittsburgh Sports, basically that it's still up in the air. And he told us to remember the hurdle Huntington Coonley cleansing, if you want to call it that, where it was just that, a clean sweep of the people atop the food chain there by Bob Nutting. And not a lot of us were thinking in that direction at the time, right? That he was just going to get rid of all of them. And he did. And Dejan writes that neither Nutting nor Travis Williams were part of Cherington's recent statement that I, quote, fully expect Shelton to be back. At the same time, Dejan says, I get zero vibes that Cherington is in trouble, but he has a very, very different vibe on Shelton. So I still think this could get very interesting. I mean, and here's my point. If you're Bob Nutting watching that game yesterday, your last home game in front of your people, in front of your most loyal fans, the people who show up for that thing, with your team having crumbled after the All-Star break, and that's the product you get on the field? Are you kidding me? And you might finish with fewer wins than last season? When it was Nutting himself who said we need to take a meaningful step forward, when it was Cherington who threw out the idea of 84 wins in the offseason? Put it this way, there's a much stronger argument against Shelton and Cherington than there is in favor of them. And that argument only deepens if they don't finish with as many wins as last season, and it only deepened yesterday when your last game in front of your most loyal fans turns out to be in some ways a debacle featuring O'Neill Cruz. Still a relatively close game. What was the final score? Is it a two-run game?
It was, let me find it real quick.
It doesn't matter.
5-2, yeah.
It was a close game, and he got thrown out because he didn't know how many outs there were in the eighth inning. In the eighth inning. That's what you're getting in the final home game. So I don't know. I wouldn't be too comfortable. I'll say that if I was Derek Shelton. I wouldn't be too comfortable right now. And I think as ridiculous as it may seem that these three games against the Yankees mean something, if you finish with fewer wins than last season, that's the type of thing that if Bob Nutting is wavering in any way, could tip the scales. It really could. Next. All right, the fallout from the Rowdy Tellez debacle. This became an international story. It really did, that the Pirates stiffed him out of his $200,000. With one game to go right before that. Now, again, I go to Dejan. This is interesting. He said this was nothing more than Charrington being typically tone deaf, and that Nutting probably didn't even know about it. He basically said that. Nutting had as much to do with Telez as you or I. That's fine. That's fine. If that's where your reporting takes you, and if you out there want to believe that, fine. Let's go with that. It's still on Bob Nutting, because all Bob Nutting had to do once the story became public was to stand up, pound his fist on the table like Brian Kelly, and say, we're not going to do business that way. I honestly didn't know what was happening here. This was my general manager talking. I'm going to make it right. I'm going to make it right. That's not what we do here. That's not the way to run a business. I'm going to make it right and get him his bonus. Period. Oh, I love that. Okay, so let's not let Bob Nutting slide in this. He could have fixed it in 1 second. Not the way we do business. We're going to pay Rowdy his bonus. He was here all year. All year, we're not going to keep a guy one game shy. So no matter what, no matter how you want to report it, no matter how you want to say it, no matter how you feel about it, no matter who you want to blame, this comes back to the owner. Period. The buck, so to speak, stops there all the time. So I ain't letting Bob Nutting out here on the he didn't know about it clause. Once he knew about it, he has all the power to make it right, and he didn't. Next. Thank you, Limits. You've become a wonderful man. Paul Skeens, Saturday, Yankee Stadium. And I know all the jokes will come out, and there's always truth in a joke, is that the Yankees will get a good look at him this weekend because they're going to get him in about 5 years, right? Isn't that what people are saying going into the weekend?
People love to say that. Oh, this is just the start. This is just the start for Paul Skeens. The people that do the roll call out in Yankee Stadium, they'll be saying, oh, that's Skeens' guy. Just
are they wrong?
5 years.
Are they wrong? I couldn't help but notice Gerrit Cole was taking part in a celebration with the Yankees last night. Do you think Paul Skeens signs a contract here that takes him even 1 year into free agency?
No. No, I don't.
Neither do I. They could surprise us, I suppose.
Yeah.
These contracts, by the way, that buy up your arbitration years, who gives a crap about that? You have team control over him. You might have to pay more in arbitration. You might save some money on a contract. Talk to me when you sign him at least 1 year into his free agency.
You know the wild
thing? And then I'll take everything back.
About both Jones and Skeens is, so Jones was on the opening day roster, and he never spent any time in AAA. See, he automatically gains a full year of service.
Yeah.
So 1 year gone of extra control for Jones.
Yeah.
Skeens, you called him up in May to be able to get an extra year of service, but he was obviously one of the main candidates to win Rookie of the Year, even when he came up, even before he was brought up. And now he will not have an extra year of service because he will finish either one or two in Rookie of the Year.
Right, and people want to give the Pirates, by the way, credit for things like that. For simply doing business the right way.
I gave them credit yesterday for calling up Skeens in May, earlier than we all expected.
I didn't give them credit for that. I said it was their best move, but it's the cost of doing business in Major League Baseball.
Which sucks.
Huh?
Which sucks. That's just the reality of it, though. You will lose control of both of those guys for an extra year.
Who cares?
A small market team. I think it matters.
When do you want them to win?
Now, but you want that to be further extended.
Would you be saying this if they were two games out right now and they had Skeens and they didn't have Skeens for the whole year or Jones?
What they should have did is did the opposite. They should have called up Jones a little bit later on. I know it's 2020 vision at this point, but didn't we all think that Paul Skeens was going to be top two in Rookie of the Year voting? I mean,
if I could recast perhaps my statement about them doing Skeens, it would be one of their best organizational moves this year was stepping out of character and having a guy come up when he should come up and maybe even still a little late. Honestly, I think Skeens could have handled Major League Baseball out of spring training.
He could have. He could have been on the opening day roster.
I think he could have. You've been calling me out a lot, Limits. I actually like that. We made it all the way to the PM show yesterday with a mistake I made that I'll get into in a minute.
Alrighty.
And you alerted them to it, and I appreciate that.
Well, Pony called me out on it and asked why I didn't call you out on it.
You did call me out on it. You said it right on the air, which is fine, which is good.
When did I say it on the air?
Yesterday we talked about
it. Oh, yeah. Okay. Now I remember. I thought we were talking about it a couple days ago. It's all mixing together.
You got to have a little tension here. That's what makes a show.
It makes a good show.
Now, there was a lot of tension when Ron was in the building and when I did a show with Mulsey. I think we're getting there. Where am I? What were we talking about? What was I about to say? O'Neill Crew. Oh, the other thing with Skeens is I think there might be a lot riding on this start Saturday. I don't know what the baseball writers are thinking as far as Rookie of the Year goes. Tell me the odds right now. Look up the Vegas odds. It's gone back and forth and back and forth. If he gets blown up, and this might not be fair, but I'm trying to read the minds of baseball writers, which isn't always an easy exercise. These are the guys keeping Barry Bonds out of the Hall of Fame, after all. What are they thinking? If he goes into Yankee Stadium and dominates in his final start, maybe he clinches Rookie of the Year. If he gets hit up, maybe they lean back toward Jackson Merrill, who's having, in some ways, a historic year of his own, right?
Skeens is the favorite on FanDuel, minus 250. Jackson Merrill's plus 185. How about this? The next closest is Jackson Churio at plus 15,000. So it's runaway. Skeens and Merrill's going to be in the top two. And then Shota Imanaga is plus 20,000.
Yeah, I'm not worried about those guys. I'm worried about Skeens and Merrill because I've seen different odds all year. I wrote about this 3 weeks ago, and it was Merrill was the favorite then, but now you're right. Wherever I look, Skeens has taken over. Let's hope he clinches the deal, right? Let's hope he clinches the deal on Saturday at Yankee Stadium.
And his ERA is dipped below 2. It's at 1.99. So he's a couple innings away from qualifying for the ERA title as well.
Yes.
And he has blown everybody away ERA-wise. The next closest is Chris Sale at like 2.36.
Off the top, presented by JP Roofing and Siding, we have all kinds of treats today from Ray Fittipaldo. B.B. Flannery is going to join the show later. Legendary basketball player Bob Walk's final appearance. We've got wheels of ball and all kinds of things moving here. Fan Twitter brought to you by South Hills Kia Peters Township. Visit them at southhillskia.net. Fan Hotline presented by Sullivan Super Service, providing trusted plumbing and HVAC service for over 50 years. Next. Thank you, Wonder Twin. Let's hear from Justin Fields on the Cam Hayward podcast. This was rather interesting.
Coaching. Pittsburgh or Chicago?
Pittsburgh.
That was it. It's not close. Come on.
Coaching, Athens or Columbus?
Columbus.
Okay. Teammates, Columbus or Athens?
It's tough. I got to go with Columbus, though.
There you go. Pittsburgh or Chicago?
Pittsburgh.
There we go.
Interesting. And at one point you said it's not close
on coaching
on the coaching front. Yes, it's not close. Having said that, isn't that kind of obvious? Wouldn't that be Chicago against 20 other franchises?
Well, it could be obvious to us, but is it obvious to the players who are there day to day that are going through it? Which, I mean, obviously you would think they would know more so.
With Matt Eberflus? Yes, I think so. They stink, and their coaching stinks. And it's a miracle that he's still there. Next. When is the Steelers' first loss coming? If you had to predict right now, which game will mark the Steelers' first loss? And is it Sunday at Indy, where they lost to the Fighting Gardner Minshews just last season? Limits?
No. No, they're not losing to the Colts. They're not losing to the Colts. This is not happening. Dallas, I think they can't run the ball. They're too Dak Prescott reliant.
And they might not even have Micah.
Right. If they don't have Parsons, then they don't have a pass rush. And if you stop CeeDee Lamb or if you limit CeeDee Lamb, they have no other passing options that I like.
I mean, so where's their first
loss? Ferguson's banged up. I think that their first loss, the Raiders always worry me, especially on the road. But I think
might not have Max Crosby.
Yeah, I think it might be the Jets.
So do I. If I had to pick a game right now, it's the Jets. And if it ain't the Jets.
Ravens at home? Washington at Washington, maybe.
Maybe. Maybe at Washington. Maybe. But like I said, they could be favored here for the next 2 months in every game. It's very possible. But if I had to pick right now, I'd pick the Jets. And I'm not even confident in picking that one. Last in our six-pack, which has maybe become a seven-pack. I'm stunned by the national reaction to the Oakland A's saying goodbye after 57 years. At how big a story and how many people feel emotionally connected to those fans. Like, stuff happens with franchises all the time in pro sports. And it's really not that big a story. I mean, why would Oakland be a big story even in a market like this? What do we care? And yet it seems like a lot of people care, and I'm one of them.
I care. I watched that entire game yesterday and the post-game just distraught tear session.
Because a lot of people can relate on some level or have a fear of this happening to one of their teams on some level. We were toyed with in this town when the Penguins were dangling Kansas City and things like that. And that's, no matter how justified or how much you might be able to see somebody's point in trying to gain leverage for a new arena like that, that hurts your heart if you're a fan. A longtime fan of a team, to see somebody playing with that idea of, yeah, we're going to rip the team out of the city. And I speak from experience on that. And it's happened with the Pirates, too, in the past. I speak from experience. I grew up, one of my first favorite teams, maybe my favorite team, was the Buffalo Braves. And, you know, you're a little kid then. I'm 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, just sort of arriving on this planet as a sports fan, and you gain an allegiance, and there has to be a stronger word than that. I used to fall asleep at night listening to Van Miller call Braves games, hanging on every possession. Bob McAdoo and Randy Smith and Ernie DeGregorio and all those guys. And then suddenly there's this owner, John Y. Brown. No affiliation with the city of Buffalo, who comes into town, starts talking about new arenas and things like that. And next thing I know, my favorite team as a kid is ripped away. The first thing that would happen is selling your best player. They sold Bob McAdoo, I think, to the Knicks at the time. Like, what is going on? And that's the first lesson in the business of sports. And for any of you out there and all of you out there who fall in love with these teams, who pledge your allegiance to these teams, who grow up with them, who have a familial connection, you know, father to son, mother to son to daughter, whatever it might be, who's ever taking it to games, whatever the connection might be, you grow up with that. It's passed down through your family. And then you got some guy walking into town who doesn't give a damn about any of that, just gives a damn about where his next big payday is, even though, as is in the case of the guy who owns the A's, like a lot of these people, he was born rich. His parents owned the Gap. Born rich. Didn't do a damn thing to earn his money. And now walks into Oakland, a franchise just dripping in tradition, up to and including the Moneyball movie, and beyond, a team finding a way to win with a meager payroll, partly due to the guy who came in as the owner. Maybe you're relating to part of this story now. And they get ripped out of town by this guy. And the other owners and baseball at large lets it happen? He doesn't even have a stadium in Vegas. They don't even seem to want his team in Vegas. They're going to play in a minor league ballpark in Sacramento for 3 years. What a blight on Major League Baseball. What an embarrassment for Rob Manfred and all the owners that this is happening. And what a gut punch to all these people who for 57 years have pledged their allegiance to the Oakland A's and watched one man, John Fisher, one man, walk in and rip it all away from them. And then have the gall to write them a letter, an open letter, saying, "We tried." The hell you did. There was a local sportscaster in the Bay Area who had this to say to John Fisher, and I think spoke for all A's fans and all of us who can relate to A's fans by being toyed with when owners, when franchises threaten to leave.
You surround yourself with incompetent yes men, and because you were born into a billionaire family, apparently never learned you have to spend money to make money. See Joe Lacob and the Golden State Warriors, your buddy, who still wants to buy the team. You're a serial penny pincher. You've destroyed your family's great name and legacy because of your cheapness. As for the statement about loyal A's fans, quote, "I wish I could speak to each and every one of you individually. We've been trying to interview you for years, but you always choose to remain invisible unless you're begging politicians for public funding. And then you're out in front in Las Vegas."
Wow.
For all A's fans, I can't do this enough. But here's the thing. There's one glimmer of hope. They're going to supposedly play 3 years in Sacramento.
Right.
If other owners and the Players Association had any spine at all, they would say, no, we're not doing that. Mm-hmm. We have yet to see a real financing plan for the A's stadium in Las Vegas.
Right.
We're still waiting. Vegas is still waiting. They don't have one. 18 years, they've tried. And they've screwed it up every time. I would love to see another massive failure by this ownership group. And then maybe Major League Baseball would force a sale to somebody locally. And there's a...
Amen is what I have to say to Larry Beal from ABC, reporter in the Bay Area. I think he speaks for literally millions of fans of all sports in this country. Sick and tired of that crap. Always with their hands out for us, right? These guys born into big money. Help me build my stadium or I'll leave. It's one of the most, if not the most sickening part of sports in this country. 50-minute mark on the Fan, brought to you by South Hills Chrysler Jeep Dodge, Route 19, Peters Township, celebrating 50 years in the South Hills. Listen to this show every Wednesday to hear about Starkey's Card of the Week. From the Baseball Card Castle and Cranberry contests run every Wednesday through Friday, right around noon at the 93.7thefan.com contesting page. An Ohtani card is up for grabs this week. So is a big game at Indy. And it seems to me, dear Limits, that every single person I see is picking the Steelers to win this game, yet they're only a point and a half favorite last I checked.
So are you worrying about the reverse jinx where
I'm worrying about the reverse jinx. The Indy Star ran a bunch of predictions today from around the country. Pete Prisco, Steelers 20-16. They're riding high. Their physical defense will limit the Colts' run game and make Anthony Richardson beat them. He won't. Sam Farmer, who's been covering football longer than Ron's been alive. Steelers 17-10. Justin Fields due for a bit of a letdown, but not here. Bleacher Report, Steelers 20-17. Mike Florio 20-13. The Steelers have the balance that the Colts don't. NFL.com, Steelers 20-16. I could keep going here. The Sporting News. Steelers, one of the last teams unbeaten in the AFC, doing it with a classic formula, a defense that allows 230 yards and 8.7 points a game and a conservative yet effective play from Justin Fields. What I don't think people are paying attention to is that Justin Fields was asked to win the last game, not just not to lose it. I've repeated that often on the show this week. I don't care in what form you put the ball in your quarterback's hands, even if it's, hey, don't take too many chances. When you pass more than you run, you're asking your quarterback to win a game. Sometimes the little dink and dunk plays are just as dangerous as any other plays. And he's been very accurate. And he did go down the field. He won that game for them with what some might consider a risky pass or two. He hit Calvin Austin on an intermediate throw down the seam that, if it's not timed perfectly, could be construed as a dangerous pass. It's a beautiful pass. Austin did the rest. He had a couple other throws in that game that were pinpoint, that weren't just, you know, de facto run plays. Before that final drive, he had thrown the ball 32 times and they had run it like 23 times. I don't think people are taking that into account. I think they didn't really watch the Chargers game. You know what I mean? They may have gotten some impressions from that game, but if you actually watched it, the Steelers' offense was really good as the game wore on, and Fields was asked to win the game. Here's the ball. We're going to throw it. Go win a game. And he did. I'm not sure a lot of people realize that, Austin.
No, I don't either, especially because, and Tom would harp back on this a lot, especially in the press conference. Justin Fields talked about it, is the slow starts, the first three drives. And when you have a national audience and they're watching the first couple of drives, and that's the first impression that they have of Justin Fields with the Steelers, I'm sure that that sticks with them. And especially because Fields got better and better as the game progressed. He seemed like he really settled in. First home start. Wonder if that has anything to do with his psyche. But he played significantly better as the game went on. And when they asked him to do more, he was up for the challenge.
Very well said. That's why we pay you the big bucks. I think sometimes the first impressions of a game are lasting. Who knows? Maybe people tuned in for a little bit, then went away. And if they did see the beginning, they may and see that the Steelers scored only 20 points, they may come away with that impression. But what they also might not realize is, to my way of thinking anyway, the Steelers basically scored 27.
I agree.
They decided not to score at the end.
Could have had 30 if you get complete one more 5-yard out route and let Chris Boswell have an easier field goal than 62 yards.
It was an offense that played well enough to score 30, and it wasn't because they screwed up that they didn't, I don't think. It was really a 27-30 point game by the offense. That's how I look at it. And when you mention reverse curse, that does sort of ring true, because I can't look at this game and see a real path toward logically picking the Colts. The Steelers are off to a historically great start on defense. They're healthy on defense, except for Highsmith, and the other guy came in for him and looks like a dynamo in the pass rush, Herbig does. They're going against a quarterback who's thrown twice as many picks as touchdowns and completes less than 50% of his passes. That is really hard to do in the modern day NFL. So they have an inexperienced, I think very vulnerable quarterback. Now, can Richardson make big plays down the field? Of course. And he might make a few. And he might run a little bit wild on them. But by and large, you sign up to go against quarterbacks like this. You sign up for that. Give me a guy who throws it to the other team and completes less than half of his passes. Yeah, sign us up for that one. Plus, you have some injuries maybe on the offensive line. Jonathan Taylor, a great player. They have some size at receiver. I would predict the Colts are going to spring a couple big plays for sure and probably score anywhere from 13 to 17 points. But what about the other side of the ball? The Steelers are a team that wants to run, and the Colts can't stop the run. Can't stop it. Their corners, as you heard Nick Costos tell us yesterday, are incredibly vulnerable. He called them terrible, I believe. So I think this is a game, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to pick the Steelers something like 27-13.
Is that your official prediction going on the graphic?
Yeah. I think it'll be competitive for a while, and I think the Colts will spring, let's say, two, maybe three pretty big plays in the game, like 30, 40, 50-yard type deals. I think that could happen. There's talent there. But I think in the end, the Steelers just ground them out, and this time they score that late touchdown, and they win 27-13. You?
There's a couple numbers that I look at before giving a score prediction that I think really dictate how a team is performing. It's third down percentage on offense, third down percentage on defense, and total yards defensively. Indianapolis' third down offense is 26th in the NFL. They're at 32%. The Steelers are 43%.
Yeah.
Significantly better. Total yards. Defensively, the Steelers are the best in all of football, 254 yards against. Indianapolis is giving up over 415 yards per game. That is second worst in the NFL, and they are the 28th worst defense on third down. They're giving up a first down on third down 50% of the time.
Mm.
And the Steelers defense, only 22%, and that's first in the NFL. I say that this is a pretty decent score for the Steelers. I like 28-14.
Well, we're very similar there. But yes, having said all that, you and I, limits, it's the NFL. So sometimes when all logic points to one team, the other one wins. You know what I mean?
Oh, think about the game in Oakland against Terrell Pryor.
Yeah, I think about
all those
lots games of
games against Tampa Bay. Yeah, there's one usually every
year. Think about the
year.
Patriots and Cardinals coming here last year.
And
about all of that.
Well, a lot of people like to say, which is the Tomlin game this year? Well, losing to Washington at home with the 11-0 season. Last year against the awful Patriots in the year Belichick gets fired.
I don't think it's this week. As long as T.J. Watt is at the top of his game and this defense is healthy, I don't think they're going to lose a ton. I don't. And I think this week the offense busts out a little.